CFO Radio is the only radio show that explores the passion of today's CFO and examines the innermost thoughts of the financial world, financial perspectives of tomorrow. Welcome to CFO Radio. I'm Lorraine Chilvers.
And before we start, we'd like to thank our sponsors. Delaney Consulting LLC, providing financial leadership for fast-growing companies, interim management and executive placement for the finance function. Visit DelaneyLLC.com and learn why 100% of their clients describe Delaney's services as outstanding and excellent. Also, National Association of Corporate Directors, an association created for directors by directors whose mission is to advance exemplary board leadership. We are sponsored by the Atlanta chapter.
And in this week's CFO Radio News, it is brought to us by CFO.com. The shortage of technically skilled workers that is plaguing many industries could be worse if 200,000 plus people did not leave the U.S. Armed Services each year, says CFO.com. And with the troops scheduled to depart both Iraq and Afghanistan in the coming months, there could be even more potential employees to choose from next year. They go on to say many ex-military folks find their way to factories as machinists. Someone who has been trained, for example, to maintain a fighter jet with its complex avionics and hydraulics and turbine engines will not likely need extensive additional training. That could bring enormous savings. In military people, we spend a fraction of what we do for others, says Jeff Owens, president of Advanced Technology Services, ATS, which provides manufacturers with outsourced equipment maintenance services. It was the military that invested a lot of time, energy, and money to train them, he says. More than 30% of ATS's 3,000 workers are indeed former armed force members. Besides technical proficiency, Owens says, they provide a number of other qualities that companies seek. They get to work on time. They have the discipline to execute planned predictive maintenance rather than have an I'll fix it when it fails attitude. They keep their tools, equipment, and workspace clean, tidy, and in good working order. They're respectful to customers, and they are receptive to relocation. Johnson & Johnson, for one, doesn't provide any special training for veterans beyond what other new employees get, but the company, which is well known for its extensive worker education programs, routinely promotes them and gives them crucible assignments, says Anthony Carter, Vice President of Global Diversity and Chief Diversity Officer. That group shows great strategic intent, says Carter. Strategic analysis, which I think you can associate with their military experience, often seems to rise to the top with them. CFO.com goes on to say there are some tips for hiring and working with ex-military employees, and these four tips are as follows. One, actively engage existing employees who are veterans to help interview the candidates and help them through that interview process. Two, assign a mentor to each newly hired veteran very shortly, if not in the first week of them being an employee. Three, avoid the mindset that you will only hire people who meet every qualification listed on a job description. We struggle with the concept of hiring solid citizens and training them what to do what we need, says Tim Sackett, Executive Vice President at HRU Technical Resources, an engineering contract staffing and recruitment process outsource firm. The argument that people will leave once they are trained doesn't hold water, he adds, because people rarely leave great work environments and veterans exhibit a greater loyalty than the average employee to that company. And four, and finally, don't fall into the trap of assuming that people went into the military because they weren't smart enough for college. At the years of 18, very often people don't know what they want to go into, and the military gives them very good training. Well, away from our news article today, we're on to the main crux of our radio show, and Jim Childs is joining us today. He is the President and Chief Executive Officer of Saving American Jobs Foundation, Inc. Over the last 30 years, Jim has been involved in over $1 billion in capital transactions for small and middle market companies. He has experience in all aspects of corporate finance, asset-based lending, and structured lending, including underwriting, relationship management, credit, marketing, negotiations, documentation, and closing. Jim has been involved in acquisitions, refinances, and recapitalizations in many different industries, including manufacturing, distribution, service, retail, import, and export companies with a wide variety of sizes and capital structures. Before starting his present capital consulting practice, he was managing director of the financial services group of CIT. He was senior vice president of BNY Financial GMAC. Prior to this, he was a senior relationship officer, trade services officer, and vice president at HSBC Business Credit. His initial career began with Wells Fargo and Security Pacific Business Credit, where he was involved in both asset-based and structured finance lending, or the credit relationship and marketing side. Jim graduated from the Cox Business School at Southern Methodist University with a BBA in accounting and finance. Well, my goodness, that's an awful lot of an intro. Welcome to the show, Jim.
Thanks a lot.
Well, Jim, it's great pleasure that I have you on the radio show today. And we're going to get into some very exciting topics, one of which is a strong passion and now a legally based nonprofit organization that you helped found recently. But let's start at the beginning. Let's go a couple of years back. What was your first job, and how did that lead you to arrive at your current position?
I'm not sure how much leading it was, but as a teenager, we all do all types of odd jobs.
Yes, we do. Anything that comes, it pays, right?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. My own business, cutting grass. Wow, that's great. And then I picked up golf balls, I guess, for a driving range, and eventually started working on construction projects with the engineers of major projects.
That's a whole cry away from golf balls.
It is. It is. In fact, it's much higher too. I can remember the primary job was working on a 30-story office building that was being built in Memphis, Tennessee.
So you got to be good with heights.
The original MBC. I learned that I was not good with heights, and my job was to go around the construction project and write everything down that all the subcontractors were doing during the day. And there were no walls. So you're, very, very high. And I stayed away from the edge quite a bit.
But that's
probably made me a more conservative person by
that's windy up there though, right?
That's right.
The higher you go, the more wind you have.
Sure.
So construction early on, how did that get you into the financial capital markets from there? Were you doing construction financing?
That was just a summer position while I was going to SMU, and it was really working with the engineer. I wasn't out there, pouring concrete and, doing welding and things. Those are skills that someone much better than I can do in the construction field. I took notes and gathered information for the engineers of the project.
Got it.
Right. So
moving on, then you did an accounting and finance BBA, and you just loved the finance side of things.
That's right. During while I was in school, I worked with an ex-banker who in Texas, they were changing from the unit banking model to a holding company model. And so he didn't like that. He didn't have any power to make decisions anymore. And he went out on his own and did something similar to what I'm doing now, working with companies to provide the right capital structure. And so that's where I really got my start. And then from there went on to, probably five or six over 30 years institutions, starting with Wells Fargo Business Credit. That was 9 years. It really got my training with Wells Fargo, great institution, and did asset-based lending, financing acquisitions and refinances and recaps and working with struggling companies, actually. The size were fairly small to middle market companies, started getting my passion for working with entrepreneurs and companies that were trying to make it in the world. And capital was obviously a very, very critical issue to a small and growing company or one that's struggling. So,
right. And I was going to say something, but we're going to get into very much the business that you're in terms of the nonprofit. So, okay. So that then created your kind of moves. Tell us a little bit about some of the career moves that you had, why you changed, and perhaps because within finance, we find within the CFO role, people tend to come either through the financing side or alternatively through the accounting side with some specialty in terms of whether it's tax, internal audit, maybe financial reporting. But in that financing side, you've been the financier.
That's correct.
So talk to us a little bit about the different types of financing that are out there and your experiences with those.
Well, obviously, there are three types of capital that we generally think of. There's senior debt, and that can be all different types of loans. There's junior debt, and that's something that's behind or taking more risk than the senior debt. And then there's equity, and each one of those has different risk profiles and different compensations for those types of things. Within senior debt, obviously, you have what you normally think of as bank lines of credit and term loans and mortgages and things of that nature. But as the credit risk profile changes for a company, either they're a high-growth company and they therefore their credit is more risky, or they're struggling financially. You know, it could be both sides of that problem. You tend to start turning to asset-based lenders who are much more specific with the collateral that's below them, to factoring, who are very, very specific about the accounts receivable collateral that's below them.
And so they're looking actually at long-term and short-term assets, working capital of the business, to see what can essentially be utilized as some kind of security program.
That's right, and matching the program for the types of collateral they have and what their expectations are for in the future, because you're not only financing what you have today, you're really setting up a capital structure to help you achieve whatever your goals are in the future.
And it's interesting that one of the elements that you've already highlighted are the different costs or interest rates affiliated with those elements of lending and financing. Through a company's maturity and life cycle, one potentially would try and bring some logic and say in the beginning they're high risk, but into the middle they should be slightly lesser risk, and towards a more mature career they might be even lower risk. But it really isn't necessarily at the aging of the company and therefore the experience in that regard alone. It's the activities that the company is undertaking that creates those risk patterns.
That's true. You know, no company goes through a straight line performance, so they don't start small and then just, you know, stair step up to becoming a General Motors and then failing like they did and then, you know, having to be bailed out. But so many things other than the company affect what's going on. As you suddenly a recession happens, it's just like owning your home and a recession happens and the value of your home goes down. Nothing that you did had the effect of the value of your home coming down, but you as the borrower are the person supposedly able to pay back the lender and take that risk. And that's just like with a business. With a business, as they hit, I've gone through probably six recessions now, and what happens is a recession hits and the lender suddenly has more risk in their loans. And so
they get nervous.
They may get nervous. They may start looking to tighten up their covenants and tighten up the way they lend. But in many cases, the borrower moves to a different type of lender who is more comfortable dealing with more risk. They may pay a little more interest rate. But in many cases, they're able to actually get many more dollars than their present lender. So it helps them through that time period. And then hopefully they turn themselves around and they continue to do well.
And of course, on the economic sliding scale that we have, any fluctuation in interest rates immediately impacts those that have money and have the capital means to invest. Their capability to attract higher interest rates is reduced. It's a tough market in that when times are tight, from a risk perspective, the borrower is a higher risk. But from the same regard, that interest rate to be able to go save in the economic times that we're in right now, it's interest rates are low for that from a savings perspective.
Yeah, it's all a balancing act. You know, it's a risk-reward business. And whether you're borrowing or you're lending, how much risk is there and how much is someone compensated to take that risk?
Right, right. Well, that brings us to where you are today and the Savings American Jobs Foundation. I think the name gives us very clear indication as to a little bit about the organization. But start us from the beginning. What is the organization? Why did you found it? What does it do?
Well, let's face it. I guess it's everyone is very aware of the economic problems that we're having right now, and especially as it affects people who have or actually do not have jobs anymore. Probably, you know, 90% of the population have either gone through a time where they have lost their job for one reason or another. And most do not lose their job because they stole from the company or they were an unproductive worker. Most of the people who lose their jobs are because of economic swings where companies can no longer afford the workers. Or, you know, unfortunately for the American worker, over the last 10 years since NAFTA and such, you know, companies have some economic advantages to taking some of the jobs overseas. It's just a fact of life. And so as companies have difficulty, they're one of the reasons why that companies lose jobs, workers, is that they go through they're financially struggling. And sometimes it's not even their own fault. It's, you know, they're going through economic downturn, which they did not cause. Their competitors have taken jobs overseas and makes them more competitive that they didn't cause.
And maybe payment terms are getting a little bit tough, receivables, lending terms. The customers may be paying them much later. They may be strapped in terms of that working capital cash flow in addition.
Or they may lose their largest customer. There can be mistakes by a management team. There's always that case. And especially in small to middle market companies, they do not have a significant amount of excess capital to help them through a struggling time. So generally what happens is a company becomes struggling for one reason or another. And in certain cases, capital can help them save their company. Now, we normally think of saving the company, saving the entrepreneur, but the reality is you're saving those jobs.
For the employees.
For the employees. I was told of an example recently of a company in Mississippi. They're a pecan manufacturer. And so last year, the management did not forward buy their pecans properly. Okay? They lost about $300,000 of their capital and has made it very, very difficult for them to continue operations. Now, the company is a good company. The 80 or so workers in rural Mississippi are good workers. But the problem is this company may go out of business. Very, very difficult to raise capital under $1 million for a struggling company. It's very difficult, actually, for a performing company who only needs $1 million or less to raise capital.
And isn't it a tragedy? The SBA, Small Business Association, actually quotes that if you consider Coca-Cola as one company and, Mr. and Mrs. Smith Incorporated down the road as being one company, if you rank all of those individual companies side by side, 99.7% of jobs created today are from those smaller companies, and those are companies with less than 500 employees. And
that's
so
right.
It really is the small business that, don't get me wrong, and I love Coca-Cola to death, love all the big corporations. They don't have that first stage of lending and the capital issues with that. Because they tend to have the means by which to have more flexibility. They can lay off employees, and perhaps 100 employees laid off to a large publicly held Fortune 1000 company doesn't have quite the same impact. Of course, it has the same impact on the 100 employees.
I would say that's the issue in our politics and our economy is that we think in terms of these large numbers. But in reality, in rural Mississippi, if 80 people lose their jobs
in that county,
they will not find jobs there. There are not people coming to build businesses in rural Mississippi, and I don't mean to pick on Mississippi, but rural anywhere.
Right.
If you lose your jobs, especially in those locations, there just aren't jobs being created there. So it can be very, very devastating to not only the individual, but to their families, to their ability to pay for their housing, which causes much of the housing problems we have now, but to their community, their state, federal, and local taxes are affected. So, you know, how do they afford their police department if everyone is losing their jobs in the county? It's very, very devastating. And so that was really the thought or the basics behind Saving American Jobs Foundation. You know, how can I use my credit skills and apply them to a problem that we have not only today in these economic times, but it's shielded somewhat when things are good. But how do we save these jobs? Because it helps our communities in so many ways. If someone keeps their job, then they don't become a burden to the government. They don't become a burden to charities. They don't become a burden to the public services. They continue to not only support themselves, but then support all of those projects. So that's sort of the reason, that's the personal reason that I'm involved in the in this project, because the losing American jobs, not for whatever reason, whether it's the jobs overseas or because there's a capital problem or because, you know, for whatever reason, is tragic. Tragic
is
within our communities.
And very often you've found in the last, or I've found in the last 3-4 years, that you may well have a working family, perhaps even a professional working family, middle class, I would say in terms of outward looking in. Mother and father might have been working, and let's say they had 2 children, and son and daughter were either at college or some kind of schooling, or maybe one of them was working. It's not out of the realm for mum and dad and one of the children to have lost their jobs. And that is hugely devastating to a family. Some of the impacts, not only about some of the aspects that you've said, but also health and medical insurances and their ability, to your point, to pay mortgages. And that is the first knock-on effect, is the real estate, because on an individual perspective, that is typically real estate and cars are what we tend to extend credit on.
Sure, absolutely.
So that's why the two industries have been hit. Well, let's talk about some of the really positive aspects of American Jobs Foundation. And before we start too much further, let's get some of the data elements of our conversation out. What is your website, and how can someone contact you if they're interested in helping?
Our website is under construction. The address is www.savingamericanjobs.com. Someone had .org already when we went to it, and it's one of those places where you can apply to them, and if for a fortune, you can buy that name. But so we went to .com versus .org. Unfortunately, our web designer's in London right now, so he's sort of working on it as he goes, but it's under construction. So if you went to the website, it would just say
under construction. Okay,
that's
okay.
Right. But if someone wanted to contact me, they could call me directly, which would be 770-298-7129, or they could email me at jechilds, C-H-I-L-D-S, at jameschildsllc.com.
Great. That's terrific. The great thing about radio is that people, once they've got it on podcast, can back that up and listen to it about 8 times to
right.
make sure they get it right.
Yeah,
so let's talk. There seem to be similar elements in your organization as compared to a bank. Tell us about the differences, and let's maybe talk a little bit about your business model. Who are your customers, and how do you generate money? There's a lot of questions there, so maybe let's talk about the
model first.
Yeah.
And because that's really the interesting and unique thing about this is that we are a nonprofit corporation. We're applying for C3 status.
And that's the 501c3.
So
federal tax you'd be exempt from federal taxes on that regard.
That's correct. And donations to our organization would be tax deductible as well for the individuals as well as other C3 organizations. It may be that we will get a C6 status, which will allow us to be tax exempt on our profits. But probably it will be more of a corporate initiative. And I think as we have moved down the process, anyone who knows that they've started a foundation, it is a long process that you go through to build this up.
It may take a year, perhaps.
It can. Mm-hmm. It's really building the right people, the right board members. We have 4 outstanding individuals on our board right now who have a wide variety of backgrounds, corporate backgrounds, primarily in HR, as well as compliance and audit, as well as investment banking, and in my case, corporate finance. So building the right board was our first step. We have just started reaching out to various foundations and such, as well as corporate. And we found that since our model is quite unique It doesn't fit the normal boxes of foundations, especially corporate foundations. So in many ways, we will be turning more to corporate initiatives rather than to corporate foundations to raise our capital.
Are there any other organizations somewhat similar to you out there that you can follow the footsteps of?
There is. Kiva is one that you would say is similar in that they do give small loans to entrepreneurs to help them around the developing world. So they are in the business of lending money. And let me quickly sort of summarize our model. What we will do is we'll take our capital and through other financial institutions determine companies that are struggling financially, small to middle market companies, who have anywhere from 10 to 300 jobs that they are supporting. But they're struggling financially, and their financial institution says to us, look, we really like this company. We like the board. We like their management. We believe in their product and such. But they have had some issues, some financial issues, and they need more capital to help them through this turnaround period or to help them through the next 6 months. Or let's say the federal government has just told them they need to spend $500,000 on some environmental things, and they just don't have the capital for that. So we would then evaluate for ourselves, do we believe that capital invested at the right time could help this company through their struggles so that we can save those 50 jobs or save those 70 jobs and save whatever. And then if we agree that this is a company that can make it and with the right capital support, then we would lend behind the senior lender in partnership with the senior lender. And in front of the entrepreneur, we're not giving money away. There's two sides of the political spectrum that look at our and say, this is great. And they look at it from two different perspectives. Maybe on the liberal side, you say, gosh, we need to help. We need to find a way to help people who are struggling that are at-risk jobs. We need to do that. This is a wonderful organization. On the other side, you have people that say, gosh, this is a great way to use the private sector and allow, and leverage the private sector that's already there to help save jobs at a very cost-effective way. As an example, let's say that the federal government wanted to save 10 jobs. So it would cost the government, let's say at $50,000 a piece, about $500,000 per year to create 10 jobs. Now, to save 10 jobs for us, it would cost us about $100,000 one time that we lend to the company. We will probably be paid back. But even if we didn't get a single dollar back from that $100,000, we would save those 10 jobs for 1 year, for possibly 2 years, possibly 3 years, versus the $500,000 it would take the federal government or even a private entity to create jobs. It costs so much more to create that job rather than to save that job so that a job does not have to be created. We expect that our maximum cost to save jobs will be around $10,000.
But per person.
Per person. So for $1 million of capital that we invest, we would expect at minimum 100 jobs being saved. And as that money helps the company last not only a first year, but a second year or a third year, then that $10,000 goes down to $5,000, goes down to $3,300. And then when the company actually pays us back, which we do expect, we're giving the money away, the cost of saving these jobs goes down to $0 over time. It's a great model. It's a great model. And both sides of the political question like what we're doing. But have you ever been at a football game where you liked both sides? I have children that went to different colleges, and so let's say that we went to a game where Clemson was playing Georgia Tech, and you know, when I initially started doing that, I would wear the Clemson jersey and the Georgia Tech hat, or the Georgia Tech jersey and the Clemson hat, thinking that everyone will like me. Well, no one likes you because they always see the other side. Oh, you're doing it. You know,
always see the opposition.
That's right.
The contrary view.
And in our case, the corporate side says, "Oh, you're just trying to save jobs." You know, what about your return on investment and things of that nature? And on the sort of the liberal side, we love you, you're saving jobs, but oh, you're using the private sector, you know.
Shouldn't be doing that.
Yeah, you know, it's we fall right in between the two. And mm-hmm. so although both of them really support the model from their side of the equation, they look at the opposite side. And so that's where sometimes the difficulty comes with people. But the reality is that we can save jobs. We expect to save jobs for about $3,300 per job compared to the cost of losing that job, losing the tax revenues, increasing the burdens on
and
government.
And decimating local communities.
Decimating local mm-hmm. communities. That's there are three things that we do, and that's the first thing, is that we can invest junior money for struggling small to middle market companies where there is virtually no capital available today to help save those jobs.
So would the local financial institution see you as a competitor? Would they run you out of the market, or are they going to welcome you and say, look, we can't support this level at this time, come partner with us?
I sent out information about it to about 80 professionals, and this was bankers and asset-based lenders and factors, CPAs, law firms. And I have tremendous support from the professionals. I mean, think about it. Let's say a bank has a struggling customer and they need capital. The banker doesn't want to put these companies out of business. They want these companies to be successful. If we can come in and provide the junior capital to help that company survive, we're helping their customer. We're helping their they have a long-term relationship. And really, that's where we have to be very economically conservative, in that we don't want to spend a lot of money. So we will actually use the financial institutions to introduce us into those companies that they believe, although they're struggling, with the right capital, they can make it. And that's how we will be able to get our clients, if you will, in a very cost-effective manner.
Understand. So when we look at who are your customers, you have two elements to that you've already spoken about, and perhaps one is more of a partner affiliation relationship. That is the other financial institution mm-hmm. or the financial institution. And the customer in that regard, the borrower of your financing source.
Call it the client.
The mm-hmm. client. But at the same time, we tend to think of customers as people that give us money. Mm-hmm. And so customers in the financial institution world is a little bit topsy-turvy.
Right.
So let's talk about how you gain your money and who those funding sources for you will be. Will that be the corporations? Will that be the private donor? Will that be the government grant opportunity that you have?
After several months of sort of exploring that market, we because we need large amounts of capital, we'd like to raise about $250 million to be able to spread out all over the U.S. With $250 million, we would be saving somewhere in the neighborhood of 75,000 jobs. That's a lot of money when you know for you and me to pull out of our pocket. But $250 million is insignificant when you think of the trillions of dollars that the government spends for stimulus. You think of, we have a corporation here in Georgia, someone you probably don't even think about, their public company, they have $700 million on their balance sheet right now. There is a tremendous amount of cash available in corporations right now.
So what will you do? Will you knock on their doors or will you knock on their foundation doors and ask them for support?
We recently talked with a large company through their foundation side. And yes, we are a foundation. We are a nonprofit. But most corporations have a fairly long process that they go through to determine the types of things that they want to invest their foundational money in. And that's obviously a reasonable thing. So they might say, all right, we want to put our money into middle school education. We want to put our money into cancer. We want to put our money into children's hospitals. All very, very worthy causes. No one has said, we want to put our money into lending money to other companies. You know, that's just not what they do. So we have determined that the way we will try to approach is we will go to the top level, to the CEO, to the presidents of major corporations.
And this will likely be the Fortune 1000?
Probably even lower than that. I mean, it can be smaller companies.
Maybe the mid-tier market as well.
Absolutely.
And but basically companies that have cash-rich balance sheets.
That's correct. They're successful. And they want to do something. Most corporations want to do something. That inherently, we all want to help our economy, our American economy. But people say, what can we do? And it costs a corporation a tremendous amount of money to create jobs for themselves. And then they've got to find a way to put together a new product or a new service. It's a very difficult thing for corporations to produce jobs. But for a very small amount of money, they can be a major part of helping save jobs so that we don't continue this process down the road. So for, let's say a corporation wanted to create 100 jobs, let's say, that would be $5 million worth of wages every year that they would have to, you know, be addressing to create those jobs. Well, for 100 jobs, it would be about $1 million of either donation or partnership with us so that we could go out and save those 100 jobs so that they don't become a burden on the economy. And so it's a very, very cost-effective way for a corporation to make a major impact with a small amount of money. I think you may have seen Starbucks a couple of months ago came out and said that they were seeding $5 million to a group. And then they were going to try to continue raising money through their stores.
I saw that, yes.
Yeah, they have invested it with a group of a large number of lenders around the country, which aren't really focused on saving jobs. They're just focused on lending to smaller companies, which is, again, a very valuable thing. It doesn't save as many jobs as our model, but it's, you know, it's wonderful that a corporation says, gosh, we have... Maybe we don't have a responsibility, but we want to be involved in helping the American economy. And how can we do this in a fairly inexpensive way? Well, $5 million to us would actually save from, let's see, 500 to 1,500 jobs for that $5 million coming to us. Tremendous amount. You know, I'd love to hear... You know, Starbucks, in partnership with Saving American Jobs Foundation, has a new corporate initiative to save 3,000 jobs and $150 million in wages. And to do this, we're investing or seeding $10 million to Saving American Jobs Foundation. It would be a wonderful PR benefit.
Here's what I'm going to suggest. A year from now, when you've picked up the phone and called the CEO of Starbucks, and since you've given them about 5 or 10 plugs on the radio show, I think it would be really great. I think part of the benefit of this program is to talk about the companies that are flourishing. And I've actually read the CEO of Starbucks book. Perhaps there are many of them, but I read one that essentially was his biography. And fascinating story, really fascinating story. Great success. He talks in the book about some of the failures, but how to manage growth. And when you're in the retail environment, it's a very costly growth. I think it's fabulous what they do in terms of the underprivileged small individuals that are creating the coffee beans and the milk and,
sure.
and also the water and so forth. But then also the corporations around them, they're very much a community-oriented business. So I'd like to have you back on, and I want to hear how that conversation went with the CEO.
I hope it will.
So there's a challenge to you to pick up the phone and make that call. I think it's a very unique business model, I really do. And in the world of financial institution, we've actually had one of our guests on the show from Bank of America, and we have some financial institution guests coming up and beyond that. We had a guest from RBC Bank as well. Mm. And so we've had some large-scale lending institutions talk. It's very unique to hear the plight of the small business as the way that you are describing it and the plight of the small business individual.
Many large corporations already spend tremendous amounts of foundational work. I know you hear in the press the big bad bank and all this. Do you realize that Bank of America, that you mentioned them, I think they spent about $210 million last year in foundational work. You know, boys and girls clubs, community development. I mean, a lot of these large financial institutions really have a mindset that they want to be helpful to their communities when they can. Hopefully Saving American Jobs Foundation will be another of the ways that they can actually save jobs and save their customers.
Yeah, I think it's fabulous. Well, talking about some of the philanthropic elements of how you are going to be funded, you and I, in preparation for the show, have talked a little bit about your perspective on corporate philanthropy being different from personal philanthropy. Explain this and tell us, why would a corporation donate to you or an individual?
Well, I think most large corporations have become aware that they would like to be supporters of their community in many different ways. They feel it. They believe, as a large, almost, you know, corporate citizen, that they want to reach out and do things that certainly it is building their image themselves, but it also, you know, is a good investment in their communities. I mentioned Bank of America. I mentioned Starbucks. I mean, most recently met with AT&T. Most large corporations have a sense that they want to be involved and be a leader in, especially in things that they can get involved in terms of corporate initiatives. You know, there's they may not want to provide just operating funds for someone, but if there's a particular need that they can actually fund and accomplish that need, that deals with the mindset of a corporate mentality very, very well. They may not be providing operating funds, but they will, if you can accomplish something for the monies that they give, they are open to those things. And our model is not only sustainable, but we can give very specific results. You know, we can give them very specific numbers as to how many jobs were saved for the money that they invested with us.
And of course, from a corporate perspective, whether you actually get your 501c3 or 501c6, I think you'd said, or indeed not, from a company perspective, if it's a business initiative, it will be tax allowable. From a personal perspective, individual donors, you clearly need that 501c3 in order that they can write it off. But there's also a very strong reason why an individual would donate to you, perhaps just through the common interest of saving those jobs.
There is, and we're hopeful. We're working with a large law firm and CPA firm. We are hopeful that we will get a C3 status. And because we lessen the burden of governments and because we are able to help people that have at-risk jobs, we believe that qualifies us as a C3 status. And that will allow individuals and wealthy individuals and family offices and other foundations to support us as well. You know, we mentioned the first thing. The second thing that we do, and it's just as important, is that we can take over toxic loans. Now, I'm not talking
toxic loans.
Yeah,
my goodness.
I'm not talking about toxic environmental loans. What I'm talking about is there are many financial institutions that may have lent money to companies over the last few years, and those companies have become struggling, and the bank or lender understands that if they were to liquidate this loan, they're going to lose a lot of money. Let's say they had originally lent them $4 million, and when they now look at potentially liquidating a company or putting them through bankruptcy, if they were to liquidate all the assets, maybe they would get $500,000 or so. Their committees have seen this credit 1,000 times. They're tired of it. They really would like it to be out of the bank or out of the lender. But what do they do? If they shut this company down and they liquidate their collateral, they're considered the big bad bank that is destroying jobs in this small community or whatever. And they don't want to do that. They wanted the company to be successful. They wanted to provide money to a growing and profitable and company that would be hiring more. But they're faced with a situation where, you know, they've suddenly have the option of shutting it down and getting back $500,000 versus the $4 million they've put into it. And when you look at the costs of bankruptcy and the legal costs and the management time costs, it's a very, very expensive process. What they do is have the option to sell us that loan. So we could buy that loan for a dollar, let's say. And then we could take the loan to the company and say, look, you obviously cannot afford a $4 million loan. Let's restructure that loan and make it work for you so that we save those 50 jobs, so we save those 70 jobs. And then it's not XYZ Bank is the big bad guy that just shut down 50 jobs. It's XYZ Bank, in partnership with Saving American Jobs Foundation, has donated $4 million of loans to help save 80 jobs in our community. Now, the difference in public perception alone is worth the $500,000 that they would be getting if they got those loans back.
I understand.
So especially for, you know, in smaller banks or in struggling banks, their loans are taken over through the FDIC with another bank, and those struggling loans are dealt with by the federal government. But for many profitable and major banks that just don't want to go through, they don't want to go through the process of shutting somebody down, going them through bankruptcy and, you know, calling on the guarantees and all the other the negative stuff that can happen when a loan goes bad, they would really rather be the person that helps save the company. And so we can come in and purchase that loan.
So essentially, you're not underwriting it. You're actually purchasing that loan.
We would be purchasing for a minor amount of dollars. And then we would go, instead of going to bankruptcy, we would just go to the client and say, look, let's work out something together that makes sense for you. Obviously, you can't afford $4 million. Maybe you can afford $500,000. And we'll charge a senior interest rate on that, and we'll maybe have a $500,000 of junior loan or something that we'll pick the interest for years, and you don't have to pay it back for starting in a year from now. We'll give you the time to turn your company around, and then you can start paying these loans back. Mm-hmm. The jobs are saved. The bank is the hero in this case, and we're sort of the intermediary between the two.
You're a facilitator.
That's right. That's right.
I love that.
And the key for us is that we're trying to save those jobs.
Yeah.
You know, if that company shut down, it's just devastating.
Yeah. Well, Jim, looking at the business model, I'd like to be a little contrarian.
Please.
I love contrarian views. They incite great conversation. One could look at your business model and say we're in a down economy, we're the U.S. economy and many abroad, and we hear about failing economies in Europe as well as further abroad. The model is going to survive in a down economy because companies are laying off and continuing to do so. Explain how, on a long-term basis, you expect this business to last and whether there is still room for the model in good economic times.
Sure. We're very different. We're a very sustainable model. In most foundations, let's say they get $10 million in donations 1 year, and that year they spend $10 million. And the next year they need another $10 million, and then they use those as $10 million. Well, our program funds go to loans. So these are loans that we expect the companies, once they turn themselves around, to pay us back.
And you'll have legal documentation surrounding all of that, of course.
Oh, absolutely.
Agreements will be in place.
And we're not giving the money away. We're allowing them to use our money to help save those jobs. And then once they are and the company is going well, they can pay us back. During that time, we'll get an interest rate similar to a junior capital. And from those funds, we're able to pay for our operating costs, all of our, you know, the employees and things of that nature. And because we don't have investors that we have to pay, it allows us to do the smaller loans where a normal junior capital provider would start at $1 million, and really they would rather invest $2, $3, $4, $5 million because the cost of running a loan in a junior position is very expensive. And so when you have to pay your investors back 12% or so, it leaves very little to make mistakes. But because we don't have investors, we can make a few mistakes and still sustain ourselves very nicely.
And you've obviously got a phenomenally expert board level. And as you yourself become one of being the employer, you'll be hiring people to be able to support this and your lending.
Absolutely. It's a very scalable model. In other words, people who are in the lending business understand that if you don't have the loan, you don't need the lending officer. You need to bring in lending officers as you grow. And so it's from a cost perspective, it can be managed very easily.
Very manageable, yeah.
But you asked another question. I can't.
Is there still room in good economic times?
Actually, it's a great model for good economic times. Most people don't realize that even though during good economic times, there are companies that make mistakes or they go through turnarounds. I mean, the turnaround business is obviously impacted by down economic times, so there's more work for them. But there are always companies that are struggling financially during even the good times. And it may not be that they're struggling because of a marketing issue or a market issue. It may be something else, like their major competitor took their jobs to China and therefore they've dropped their costs. And so for a period of time, while they work out what they can do, they have a capital issue. There's lots of things. So our model is sustainable so that the good and the bad times, we can self-fund ourselves once we're there. But during the good times, there are many, many companies that still
that you can help
that still struggle financially, and we can help.
Well, explain. You've talked a little bit about some of the loans that are out there and available, but are there any specific loans currently available from the government to companies? And to what extent are you providing support either in addition to them or bilaterally, maybe even you're competing against those loans?
We're certainly able to work with those that presently have SBA, SBIC type loans, because we don't provide the whole financing. We only provide the critical financing. So the SBA loan may have a senior SBA loan, but the company may start to struggle and they need the additional capital, and then we can come in and provide the capital so they can maintain their SBA. The SBA and SBIC's programs are terrific. From a client perspective, they're very, very bureaucratic. They're very, very, what's the word I'm trying to think of? They're like it's a bunch of boxes, and if you don't qualify with every box, then you can't
get the loan. It's policy driven.
It's very policy driven. You know, you check the box. Did they do this? Did you have this profit? Did you do this? And
if you don't meet the requirements, there's no discussion.
Very little discussion. There are some great banks out that do a lot of the work for SBA right now, and they're great. And so for those that do qualify and can jump through the hoops, they're very good programs, especially for the senior. In terms of junior capital, SBA doesn't really provide that much junior capital unless you're really performing well right now, and the SBICs as well.
And those loans that are government-oriented tend to be focused on those companies that have strong assets, so real estate, albeit with a depressed value and
personal assets behind the personal guarantees. Yeah. They generally take a position on the personal assets of the owner, mm-hmm. which we can, but we don't really look to do that.
Got it.
Yeah.
So in that regard, I'm afraid we are coming to the end of the show. We've talked a fabulous amount about your organization. And here on CFO Radio, once per month, we do offer the opportunity to nonprofits to give a shout out. As a final element, is there anything that you would like to do in order to help individuals and corporations contact you or get to know more about you? Are there informational sheets that if they contact you, you can provide them?
Absolutely. We have things we can email them with very, very specific information about not only our organization, but what we're really the need that's out there. And if they'll call me at that number that we mentioned earlier, if you like, I can give it again.
Yeah, go ahead.
770-298-7129. Or email me at jechilds@jameschildsllc.com, and I can get that information to them. Absolutely.
Yes, that's great. Well, before we wrap up, we have a tradition on the show to ask all of our guests, what is your CFO tip of the month? From the perspective of the financier, what is yours?
My biggest tip would be to learn to delegate. Learn to delegate and manage the process. So many chief financial officers come up through the accounting side. Maybe they go into a controller role. They're dealing with numbers all day long. They're very good at what they do because that's why they get promoted. They're very good with numbers. They're very good with explanations and things. So, but as they are promoted to a chief financial officer, they still want to hold on to doing the things their way because they do it very well. There's no doubt about it. You learn a lot more spreading a financial statement than reading a financial statement. And as they grow in that role, they have to learn to delegate. They have to learn to bring on people who are as talented and as skilled as they are, so that those people lift the whole boat. It's not, I find so many that hold on so long to the HR duties, to the controlling duties, to the purchasing duties, to the receivables duties. They've got to learn to delegate. And they don't have to delegate to someone inside the house. They can delegate to someone who comes in on a part-time basis to do that for them. Like in my business and capital, most of them can do it if they had the time of day, but most of them are 80-hour work weekdays, work weeks anyway. So just learn to delegate. Learn to delegate to good people.
Well, that's a great tip. Thank you. And with a formality around it, thank you very much to Jim Childs, our guest today, for sharing your innermost thoughts on the role of the CFO and financing.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure having you. And thanks also to our contributor, CFO.com, and to our sponsors, Delaney Consulting, providing chief financial officers and controllers to Fortune 1000 companies and small businesses alike. For more information about Delaney, go to www.delaneyllc.com. And thanks also to National Association of Corporate Directors, Advancing Exemplary Board Leadership for Directors by Directors. Their website can be found at nacdonline.org. This and other thought leadership from today's CFO is available right from your computer at cforadio.com. If you are a chief financial officer and would like to be a guest on the show, or perhaps know of someone in a leadership position in finance, please contact us via the web at info@delaneyllc.com. Thanks for listening to CFO Radio. This is Lorraine Chilvers signing off until next time.